Live from Burbank, California, where you can get someone else's credit report for free. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, let's start this charade. Mark Maron.
Hey. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? Welcome aboard. This is the Mark Maron Show. We are blogging the night away at markmaron.com if you'd like. Man, I am jacked. I don't know what the hell happened today, Jim. I don't know what the hell happened. Should I set up the show? I think I'm having a manic episode. I really do. I felt kind of skittish.
How can you tell?
With me, I have this weird, intense, anxious clarity for about an hour or two. I'm not like my father, though. Unfortunately, I'm not gifted with all-out manic depression. I just have these, these moments of mania that last. They're not moments. They might last a day or 2 days, and then it's just back to the dysthymic reality that is my life. The kind of chronic, mild cynicism laced with anxiety that some people would call depression. I call it being realistic.
Where was your wife during the?
What are you talking about? My wife for? What's going on? Where'd that come from?
No. I was just asking. Was she there by your side? Was she helping you out, or was she, pursuing her career?
Here's what I said. Here's exactly what I said. I said, man, I'm anxious. I'm aggro today. And she said, me too. I got to go practice my show. And that was the end of that. So then I tried to reach out to some other people. I was like, who should I call? Maybe I should call Sweepy Bill Kolar, my producer.
Good idea. He doesn't have enough.
Yeah, well, he doesn't have enough things to do than to babysit me. Hey,
yeah.
Come on. This is part of show business, is babysitting the prima donna host when he has a manic episode and needs some attention. But did I call him? No. I was responsible. I was reasonable. I started to eat directly out of the jar of peanut butter. And then I had some nicotine gum and three more cups of coffee, because that helps. The mixture of nicotine gum, peanut butter, and coffee somehow has a antidepressant effect on me, and it levels the mania in the same way that Ritalin helps hyperactivity. Can you tell? It's really worked.
Yeah, it's really worked, man. Sure, man.
What? Come on,
speed up. Put the gun down.
The gun.
Put it down.
I'm just playing
Step
with it.
Step away from the piece.
I'm just playing with it. Hey, we got a great show today. We've got comedian Mort Saul is going to come and tell us a history of stand-up comedy, because I believe, Jim, I don't know if you're the same as me, but for most practical purposes, you're not at all like me, other than we're in the same business and we pretend to like each other on the radio. But
now you're going to get the bloggers running on that.
Oh, let them run. But Mort Saul, I believe, helped define the difference between what I see as comedians and stand-up comics. I'd rather be called a stand-up comic or a stand-up than a comedian. I'll answer to any of the three. But I think at the time that Saul and Lenny Bruce came around, a comedian was somebody that the entertainment industry accepted as basically a clown that told jokes. And I think that the generation that Saul helped define with Lenny Bruce became the stand-up comic. Stand-up comic to me means somebody that is more individualistic, somebody who has their own voice, and somebody who might even be provocative. That's where I think stand-up came from. I might be wrong. I'll ask him. We're going to have the director of the documentary Wordplay, Patrick Creedon, will be here. Very touching movie. I watched it. Did you see? There's a whole new genre of film now, the geekumentary, about nerds with a purpose. Like, I watched the Spellbound movie, which I thought was great, but that was kids. Now, these are full-grown, smart, nerdy people that are very endearing, and they have a better job and livings than we do. These are people who have real brains, Jim, that didn't waste them like you and I. There's the guy, Will Shorts, who does the crossword for the New York Times and runs the big tournament. And these people are so sweet. Yeah, they're the people that you and I made fun of. Did you make fun of them when you were younger?
I didn't make fun. I knew they were dangerous.
Yeah.
I knew they were very, very dangerous.
I didn't make fun of them because I felt a little sad for them, but I knew that ultimately they'd do much better in life than I would. They just wouldn't have as good a time necessarily. But we're going to talk to him about Wordplay because it's going to be opening soon. And from the blog TalkLeft.com, we're going to have Geraldine on to bring us up to speed on the Duke rape case, which I know very little about, but I know it's important in terms of how women are represented in the courtroom, obviously, and how the legal system represents itself, obviously. And, obviously, I can't stand the guys that did it because I've always hated those kind of guys, but are they guilty? Are they not? How is that case being handled? Do you know anything about it, Jim?
I know. All I know is that Bill O'Reilly is pro.
pro,
pro-rape.
Pro-rape,
yeah,
that's for sure.
In that case, I think he's pro-rape.
Here's the good news, though, that I want to lay out there, and I think you'll know how I spent my day after reading this story and why I think it's good news. Apparently, a study shows that heavy, long-term coffee drinking does not raise the risk of heart disease. And let's put a sound effect right here. Like a yay, or a da-da-da-da, or like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum, yow.
Or a heart.
No, it would be like boom, 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 boom. That's more like blow heart. That's cocaine heart. Boom, 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 boom,
blow boom, heart. Boom. That was a great movie, by the way. Blow heart.
Blow heart's one of my favorite movies. It's just that guy kind of yelling about stuff for 2 hours. You know, I think it was a
Mel Gibson.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The Art Pagosian thing. I think it was that was a blow heart. But no. Boom, boom, boom. But coffee, apparently, even though it jacks you up, not going to kill you, thank goodness, because
really?
I've had 29 cups today.
So caffeine is not a detriment in big...
What are you talking about? I've moved on. Let's go.
And heroin.
Heroin just makes you think everything's okay while your hair falls out and you get scabs on your arms. Not an attractive drug. Here we go. Let's do this. A lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure you're up to speed and informed. So here's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. A naked man. Is that the one I want to do first? No. Congressional leaders of both parties are pressuring President Bush to launch an investigation into whether the skyrocketing cost of gasoline is a result of price gouging by big oil companies. According to a recent CNN poll, 69% of Americans say gas prices are causing them severe financial hardship, while the remaining 31% say they're happy those bastards who can afford cars are finally getting their comeuppance. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says repairs to New Orleans' system of levees will not be finished in time for hurricane season. By 2010, the Corps will have made the levee system, quote, better and stronger than it ever has been, end quote, if Congress is willing to spend the necessary $4 billion. In a time of massive deficits, members of Congress can only hope New Orleans gets another hurricane catastrophic enough to justify spending all that money. It's a long joke, long way to go for that. You know,
that's very, very informative, though.
Yeah, Mort Saul would have done a joke similar to that, and it would have got tepid response. But you would have said that fella's smart.
Well, you got to read it while you have a newspaper in your hand.
Another joke. Yeah, and you have to have several papers if you can, and then get away from the papers. Hey, a naked man. You see how he brought that around?
I like that.
I kind of teased this joke at the beginning by accident, and now we're at it.
Hey, a naked man.
A naked man was arrested after spending 5 hours stuck in the chimney of his stepmother's house. Police handcuffed the naked man covered in soot, despite his claims that he was acting in a menstrual version of hair. Local police noted that in Hayward, the man is known as an idiot. In New York, it would be known as David Blaine. I'm going to keep going. Police later, the man drunkenly explained he was working on a new book called 'Twas the 245 Nights Before Christmas. Huh? All right, that's the short order news. That's it. Now I've got no second round options for that joke, but I think I'll find one. I'm letting you in on the process too much. I'm letting people know how it works, which is what I did last night at that benefit that no one came to.
No one came to it? Really?
Man, the Friars Club? Have you been to the Friars of Beverly Hills?
Not here, no.
It's a fascinating old place that there are just pictures on the wall. So not only was there no one there, but I'm on stage being judged by the paintings of dead clowns. Do you understand? I had Shecky Green looking at me from the wall, Milton Berle looking at me from the wall, Dick Buttons, who's not dead yet, he was looking at me from the wall.
Dick Buttons? Red Buttons, you mean?
Yeah, Dick Buttons was a skater. Red Buttons was a comic. How did I know Dick Buttons was a skater? You know why?
I don't know.
It's a long story. I don't think we have time to get into it.
Because you're an ex-jock.
Yeah, that would be why I would like a figure skater from the 40s or whenever the hell he was.
Well, you weren't doing it right.
We have things to talk about, all right? We have serious things coming up. There is price gouging going on. There's a war about to happen. They're testing nuclear bombs in Nevada to get ready to blow up a country. And we're sitting here speculating about Dick Buttons and the true nature of me.
And also the novel We by Yevgeny Zamyatin.
See, that's the problem. People want to know about that. You say that's the guy that George Orwell ripped off.
I didn't say ripped. Well, he kind of did. Orwell kind of admitted
it. I think
it.
If we were to go back, you will have said ripped off. Okay. No, he admitted it because he said he probably agreed that he extrapolated from some of the ideas of that book that you're mentioning. But who the hell knows how to spell that name? We're going to have to put that up on the blog. Say the name again.
Eugene Zamyatin with a Z.
You said that like that clears anything up?
Yevgeny. It's Russian.
That's ridiculous.
Soviet.
Yevgeny, we got to go. We're going to talk to Geraldine from Talk Left in just a second.
And now, Stakes! Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. In a little while, we're going to have the director of the documentary Wordplay, Patrick Creedon, is going to be here, and also Mort Saul, the comedian. And you're not going to believe this. Tom Cruise is calling the show. I don't know if he's mad about what I said about Scientology or what, but he's calling the show. I'm not kidding. You can believe me if you want. I would, because I'm telling the truth. I screwed that up. Talk Left is a great blog because it is eclectic. It covers interesting and different stories than most of the political blogs. And it has one of the most impressive link lists I've ever seen. Joining us right now from Talk Left to talk about some legal issues that are going on out there is Geralyn. Welcome to the show, Geralyn.
Thanks, Mark.
Hey, can I ask you a quick question before we get into the news? The one name in the blogger world, who decided to do that?
Decide what?
To just have one name, like instead of a whole name.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Oh, because you just go by the name Geralyn on the blog, don't you?
Oh, yeah, but there's a link. You can get my last name, Merritt.
Oh, okay.
I just didn't want to put myself out there that much.
Oh, okay.
A link where people can find out who I am.
Okay, good. Now, let's talk about, the Moussaoui trials, there's things going on with that. Zacharias Moussaoui, the jury is still deliberating, and you would have thought in the culture that we live in now, with the amount of feelings about 9/11 and who that guy was, that they would have lynched this guy immediately.
You know, you certainly could think that. They went out for deliberations about 2:30 yesterday afternoon, did a couple of hours, and came back today and went the whole day, and then retired without a verdict.
That's bizarre to me. And now, is it because that there's just so much evidence to go over, or that they're not sure they want to set a precedent of killing this guy because he didn't actually participate in the crime? Why do you think that they are taking so long to speculate about that?
Well, I think part of it is that their verdict form that they have to fill out is 42 pages. And it's a list of what we call aggravating and mitigating factors. In other words, in order to sentence him to death, the jury first has to go through this whole list of factors that the prosecution or the government alleges. Things like he created a grave risk of death, or that he committed this crime in a cruel and heinous manner, and after a lot of planning or deliberation. And they just list them, and they all have to take a vote on yes or no as to each one. Once they get done with those, they have to turn to what the defense is arguing as mitigating factors, things like he had this horrible childhood, and they all have to vote on those factors. And then they have to weigh them and figure out whether what the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating or vice versa.
That's amazing to me. They're arguing that he had a horrible childhood, so Zacharias Moussaoui's parents could take the hit here.
Well, they could get him off the death sentence, that's for sure.
I can't believe that they're going to buy that. Is the case revolving around the fact that he actually was an active planner despite the fact that he didn't get into a plane?
That's what the prosecution is arguing, and is that, you know, he was, you know, by his lying to them, he failed to do anything that would have allowed them to prevent 9/11.
Okay.
And that his intent in coming to the United States was to learn how to fly a plane to later attack America. But, you know, as the defense pointed out and as the evidence showed, this guy was like a bumbling holy warrior. Al-Qaeda didn't like him. They testified, you know, they had depositions from Al-Qaeda members that were holding in secret prisons overseas that said they didn't trust him and they wouldn't have let him have been a part of 9/11. And then Moussaoui took the stand and blamed it all on the shoe bomber, Richard Reed. And the jury was told at the end that even the government didn't believe him.
So these two guys, Reed and Moussaoui, are trying to portray themselves as sort of like the keystone Al-Qaeda members.
For Moussaoui, it's even worse. He's trying to say that the two of them were going to attack the White House together. And even Richard Reed says, what are you talking about? I wasn't part of any plan to attack the White House.
Oh, my God.
And even the government says, the point is that, you know, the real interesting issue here is Moussaoui trying to get a death verdict? You know, does he think that he wants to go out as a martyr with a death penalty so everyone in his world will proclaim him a successful holy warrior?
As opposed to a whack job goofball.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and is that preferable to him to spending the rest of his life in a maximum security prison at Supermax in Florence, Colorado, which is a miserable existence?
So if you were, as a legal analyst, if you were to give me odds on this, what do you think the jury's going to say?
Oh, you know, I'm kind of torn. You know, conventional wisdom would have it that they're going to give him the death penalty. This is a jury that was selected from the area where the Pentagon attack happened. It's filled with, you know, military employees. And Moussaoui is such an unsympathetic character. And, you know, I don't know that they'll buy that he's just nuts. The guy has a master's degree.
All right, so we'll see what happens with that. Let's move on towards the to the three white Duke University lacrosse players who were accused of raping a black stripper, at an off-campus party. Now, two have been charged with the rape. So why don't you bring us up to speed on that and the social implications and legal implications of this case?
Okay, well, as you said, two have been charged. The DA says he intends to charge a third, but the next grand jury meets on Monday, and the DA is up for re-election on Tuesday. So today, even he said it would look a little too political if he indicted the third guy on Monday. So he's going to hold off on that. But they're really going after these kids. Today, the DA in Durham, you know, decided that he's going to revoke the deferred, what they call deferred prosecutions of the other several of the other players on the team. They had minor alcohol offenses from last year, and they were given, as most young kids are, diversion. And even though they were not charged with being involved in the rape, the DA says he's going to revoke those because they attended a party where alcohol was served and a stripper attended.
So the interesting thing about this case in terms of social issues and cultural momentum is that it's very easy to characterize this woman, as somebody who was making herself available to this type of treatment. That is what the prosecution is trying to say, right?
The prosecution is essentially saying that they believe this woman, that she was raped.
I'm talking about the defense. The defense are trying to demonize her, right?
Okay, yeah. The defense is saying that she's lying.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not saying she's lying because she's a stripper. They're saying she's lying because she has, yesterday they filed a motion seeking her medical records, psychiatric records, drug abuse treatment records, and they're portraying her right now as someone with serious drug problems who's not to be believed. They're going after her credibility not so much because she's a stripper, but because she has told different versions and because they say she's lying.
Well, Geraldine, thank you for joining us. Hope we can do this again soon.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
You take care.
Okay,
bye-bye. That was Geraldine from the blog Talk Left. It's a great blog. It is eclectic, and you should visit it. We're going to be back with Patrick Creedon to talk about crosswords. It doesn't sound compelling, but man, is it.
Now, he has a child named Zippy, Mark Maron.
Oh, God, sometimes I wonder if I have a kid out there somewhere. I think I would have been contacted by now.
That's not you? You don't have a child named Zippy?
No, but I've had moments where I was thinking about my behavior in the 80s and the 90s, and I wonder if there is someone out there that is my child, and I think I would have known by now. Or maybe that person just waiting until I become more successful to ask me for money. I don't know. Hopefully not. There's that possibility as well. Why are we talking about this? Why'd you bring that up? I don't have a child named Zippy. I don't have any kids. I have cats. Are you a crossword guy? Honestly.
But Heather is.
Okay, well, there you go.
A crossword woman.
There was actually a period in the early 90s when I was living in an apartment with four other comics, and it seemed that all we looked forward to was doing the New York Times crossword puzzle on Sundays. Obviously, it was generally a group effort that unfolded throughout most of the day. I had no idea, my friends, what went into creating a crossword, how many people, who they were. I could have assumed what kind of people did them every day, but even that is surprising. Patrick Creedon answers all these questions and more in his new film, Wordplay. He's with us now. How are you, Patrick?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Now, what compelled you to... Are you a crossword guy? I mean, what made you say, this is interesting?
I said, what would be the most unexpected topic to make a movie about, and crossword puzzles sort of jumped into my head. So.
Now, there seems to be this whole new type of documentary that maybe I'm generalizing just based on the fact that the Scrabble movie was so popular, and that was kids, but there is a sense that if those kids grew up, they would be the people in your movie.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. I mean, I think the people in our movie tend to be extremely good at what they do, and so that alone, I find that to be interesting. If you meet a group of people who are extremely talented in one thing. It's I find it interesting to find out more about them and to sort of dive into that.
Well, I'll have you know that, you know, in about the first third of the movie, I actually, you know, welled up a little bit. I'll tell you why in a second. But what people ought to understand about this movie, Wordplay, is that it follows there's a few trajectories. There is the history of crosswords, and there is the construction of crosswords, and there are these professional, they're not even professional, they're just expert crossword puzzlers, who are moving towards an international, I guess, competition in, where is it, Northampton, Connecticut?
They have it in, it's in Stamford.
Stamford, Connecticut, at the Marriott every year. And as you would expect, this is a fairly nerdy group. But the guy, that what is also fascinating to me, what sucked me into the movie right away, more so than what's his name, Shorts. What's his first
Will
name?
Will Shorts.
Will Shorts, the guy who does the crossword for the New York Times. Although he did find a college that would allow him to major in puzzles.
He actually has a major in enigmatology. Uh-huh. He's the only person on the planet with that degree. So,
but the guys who construct them, there's a series, he edits it, I guess, and then he subcontracts to about 100 people who construct puzzles. And the guy who's constructing the puzzle, you just, there's a shot that you have in there where he's sitting alone in a big house at this table with what he makes a living doing, and he's loving it. You know, he's filling boxes with words, and that, I found that to be very human.
Yeah, he's, that guy's name is Merle Regal. He lives in Tampa, Florida, and he's a professional crossword puzzle constructor. That's how he makes a living. And
fascinating.
He's a funny guy. He's a punny guy. He, you know, having a conversation with him usually goes off in about 100 different directions because he likes to roll words around in his head and play with them. So in a way, he's sort of, he's kind of like a comedian, but then he's also like a spelling sort of acrobatics type guy. He can jumble letters and words all day long, and he's I don't know, I found that cool to
well, it's
to
compelling
explore.
It was compelling because there's something about the people that you have in the film, their dedication to this form, that reveals something about their psychology, about their emotional structure, about how they fit in the world. And then when you have the historical subtext going of just how important and how intricate, not intricate, but how integrated the crossword is into American culture. I mean, you've got people like Ken Burns in the film. You've got a bit with Jon Stewart, you know, literally talking about. My wife is a little compulsive about it. I personally don't have the patience. I tend to give up and not. The hardest thing for me in crossword puzzles was accepting that I can't finish them and just throwing them away and letting it go. But, you know, you started to follow also the gentleman who's got a family who's heading towards the competition and an ex-winner of the competition. But I just felt that the humanity that this compulsive yet, you know, harmless hobby really showed these people. I found it very touching, that woman, Ellen. I found her story, like, literally made me cry a little bit.
Yeah, she, you know, I think if our movie does one thing, it says that people want to feel like they belong to something,
mm-hmm.
whatever that thing is. And this group of people, whether it's Ellen Ripstein, who you've never heard of in your life and you'll probably never see her again. She's not a famous person in any other way, shape, or form, except that she's extremely good at solving crossword puzzles. And then you have someone like President Bill Clinton, who's in the film. And those two people have nothing in common except for the fact that they really enjoy doing crossword puzzles. And so the trick was to try to figure out what it is about these puzzles that people enjoy and why they're drawn to them. And so we just dove in and sort of figured out, we let the story sort of lead us through to where we ended up, which is, you know, don't take my word for it, but what people have said is that it's extremely funny and
compelling and human.
It's funny, but it's also very, there's a lot of drama at the end of the film. It's like a who's going to win, and it's I don't know, it's just a blast.
Well,
it's really fun.
I think what's funny about it, and I think the humanity of it, is really that you have this group of people that are focused on something seemingly, you know, innocuous and not necessarily that important to other people. And they are so focused on it and so emotional about it, and it really defines their competitive spirit, their mental acumen, or if that's what you say. And it defines who they are as people. And it comes through. There's something about the grid of a crossword puzzle that just illuminates these people's humility. I mean, and these are people that probably have been made fun of their entire life. They're square pegs in a way, but they were always the type of nerds in school that I knew they were going to be fine. They may not have as good a time as, or the type of good a time that I have, but they will ultimately do better than me and probably lead healthier life.
And yeah, and that's actually one of the other things that we thought was interesting was that you think people who do crossword puzzles are a certain type of person, but then the other people in the film who are well known in other walks of life are people like Jon Stewart,
mm-hmm.
or Bill Clinton, or Mike Mussina, who's a pitcher for the Yankees. I mean, these are people who are, you don't think of those people necessarily as being nerdy or
no,
geeky.
But wait. There's a difference between someone like me or Jim here, or my wife,
what?
Doing a puzzle occasionally, or his girlfriend. There's a difference between that and even a compulsive nature, like I got to do the puzzle every day, than a guy sitting at home going, if I don't do this under 2 minutes, I'm never going to make the finals. All right, there's a difference.
Absolutely.
And the difference is, I think you're talking about the barrier between nerd and just hobbyist. I really
absolutely. Think. You know, if you draw an analogy, it's like millions of people play golf, but there's only about 100 people who are so good that they might win a tournament every weekend. And so this is a look at people who enjoy this sport or mental exercise as a hobby, but then there's also a group of people who are really, really, really good at it. And so we focus on both groups of people.
And it's more than just a sport, though, because this requires a certain brain capacity that most people don't have, not even a good golfer. You know what I mean? Like they
absolutely.
Really, I mean, I found it fascinating to watch that guy plow through a puzzle in 2 minutes. I was surprised at how engaging the film really is.
Yeah, like I said, we had a colleague of ours a year ago who said, crossword puzzle movie, that's a terrible idea. Well, I mean, what are you thinking? You're going to spend a year on a movie about crosswords?
How'd you get Clinton to do it? I mean,
we just got lucky. I mean, he's a big fan. He really is a big fan.
He's
the puzzle just about
guy.
Every day. He's a brainy guy. Crossword puzzles, I think, fit into a basic human need to figure things out.
Or be controlling.
Yeah, or to get the perfect answer to something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And that if you figure out a crossword puzzle from start to finish, it's just extremely gratifying.
It is, absolutely.
If you don't do them, that's okay. The movie is really for a general audience.
You almost feel like you did something that mattered.
Yeah, like you just got something done. You got one thing done in your day.
Yeah.
We didn't make the movie for crossword puzzle fanatics. It's a movie for a general audience. And I think that people, whether you like it or not, whether you like puzzles or not, are going to really enjoy the film. However, it does dive into this culture, and it dives into trying to understand this basic human need to figure things out, you know, to figure something out and to get an answer, to get a perfect answer. Because life isn't really like that. You rarely get that in life. But you get that from a crossword puzzle.
Well, Patrick, back up. You tell me that I'm not going to figure this out? This life thing? Oh, my God.
I hate
God.
To be the bearer of bad news.
Stop the presses. Throw the crossword away. We're talking to Patrick Creedon. He's the director of the documentary Wordplay about crossword puzzles and everything around it. But the characters are really fascinating. And that guy, you've got Bill Clinton in there. What other politicians did you have in there?
Well, Bob Dole's in the film, too.
Right. So, I don't know how I could forget that.
Bill Clinton and Bob Dole were...
Bob Dole, who has to pull the pen out of the hand that doesn't work to do the puzzle. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I had to do that.
He and Bill Clinton were involved in one of the most famous crossword puzzles ever constructed. And I know non-puzzle people probably think, God, they keep track of these things? I mean, there's like things, like famous puzzles. But on election day of 1996, there was a puzzle that appeared. It was that same day Bill Clinton was running against Bob Dole for the presidency.
Uh-huh.
And the puzzle ran in the New York Times, and it said, tomorrow's headline.
Yeah.
And it could be answered either Clinton elected or Bob Dole elected. And no matter which way you solved it, the downward answers also sort of fit into the puzzle. So
wow.
It's that's one of the things that's featured in the film. And it's, I don't know, you look at it and you think, who thinks these things up, you know? Who
that
sits
guy.
Around and figures them out?
That
yeah.
guy sitting in Florida.
Exactly.
In
guys
his
like
big
Merle,
house.
Guys like Merle Regal sitting at his house, sitting at his big kitchen table, just figuring out these puzzles. I mean, it's a really cool, interesting group of people.
Here's a little Mark Maron trivia, if you're wondering. I was the clue of a TV Guide crossword puzzle that the clue was a host of short attention span theater, and the answer was Maron, and I framed it.
It's something very rewarding. You had the Indigo Girls talking about that in your film. That, granted, they were in the New York Times, but you know, even when I was at a TV Guide crossword puzzle, I framed it.
All right, so now let me ask you: yeah. How did you find out that you were in that puzzle?
I think someone said, "Dude, you're in the puzzle."
And then, what was it like to see your name in a crossword puzzle?
It was very rewarding. I'm telling you, I have it framed. I'm not lying. I got the cover of the TV Guide, and I got the puzzle there, and I framed it.
And there's something about like. What the Indigo Girls said, because they're in the film, and they were, the first time they saw their name in the New York Times crossword puzzle, I mean, they joked, they said that was like the highlight of our career. We felt like we'd made it.
Yeah, yeah, as a cultural icon.
Exactly.
Sure.
Because if you're well known enough to be in the crossword puzzle, then you're pretty well known.
Right. And
you know
what was interesting about that is there was something very revealing about their relationship just in that minute that you had them on, your minute or two that you had them on
exactly.
camera.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was very cute.
And that's actually something else we try to do is that I think it's kind of cool because nowadays when you watch a documentary or if you watch a television show, it's very interviews tend to be very staged and very manufactured in some way. And so what we did with our interviews is we handed everyone a puzzle, and they were answering questions, but they were kind of distracted by the puzzle, so
right.
they kind of had their guard down.
Yeah, it was good.
You know,
yeah.
And so that people are, they're answering these sort of very sort of profound questions, and yet at the same time, they're like,
hang on a minute, I got
to parts.
Five,
yeah,
but
yeah. So.
Well, Patrick Creedon, the film is Wordplay, and you did a great job. It's a very satisfying film to watch, and I wish you the best of luck with it. Thanks for being with us. We will be back with Tom Cruise, perhaps. Is that going to happen? Is that really going to happen? All right, hang out.
And now, he's stockpiling rocks. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
I can't believe what... I don't even know how the hell our booker pulled this together. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Mort Saul, comedy legend. But right now, and I... All right, I'm a little nervous, actually. Tom Cruise is on the phone. He's on the phone right now, and apparently, he's trying to... We've said some bad stuff about Scientology here.
Not me, but you.
But I don't even think that's what this is about. So, hello, Tom, are you there?
Hey, Mark, buddy, what's going on?
Not much, man. I'm thrilled that you're on our show, and I know that apparently, I guess you're back with Katie and your new daughter because you went to Rome for 3 hours yesterday. But outside of that, you've canceled all your media interviews for Mission Impossible just because of your daughter's birth. That's very commendable.
Yeah, my focus right now is just the baby, But I couldn't wait any longer to talk about the babies. I'm really here to promote my daughter.
Okay, well that's great, man. I really appreciate you joining us. So you have two adopted children, but this is the first child that's your own. Now, what was that like for you?
Oh God, where do I begin? It's amazing, spectacular, awe-inspiring, jaw-dropping visuals, mind-blowing special effects.
Are you describing a movie or?
I'm talking about childbirth, Mark.
Yeah.
It's visceral. Do you understand? It's fantastic.
Uh-huh.
Action-packed. Ving Rhames, Phil Hoffman. Childbirth has it all.
Tom, do you want to talk about Mission Impossible?
I want to talk about my new baby girl, my beautiful baby girl.
You named her Suri. Does she have a nickname of any kind yet? Or?
Oh, yeah, sure. Got to have the nicknames. Katie calls her Tootsie Roll, but I like to call her, on May 5th, Ethan Hunt is back in action in MI3.
Wait, that's not really your nickname.
No, it is. It is. Sometimes we shorten it to... Recently retired, Agent Ethan Hunt lives a slower-paced life training new IMF agents.
However,
when a new conflict arises, Ethan is called back to duty to confront the toughest villain he's ever faced.
That's obviously a plot synopsis for Mission Impossible 3.
No, it's not, I swear. We call her that because of this really cute thing she does with her hands when she sleeps. If you met the baby, it would totally make sense.
All right, let's move on, Tom.
Okay, you know what I've been thinking about lately? As amazing and awesome as childbirth is,
uh-huh.
I mean, it's been happening since the beginning of time. It's really humbling,
uh-huh.
know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are literally billions and billions of dollars in gross international box office receipts.
I thought you were going to say people on the planet, Tom.
I was. Wait, what did I say?
You said billions in box office receipts.
Oh, that's weird. No. I mean, you're right. Yeah. There are literally billions and billions of people on the planet who will see this movie.
You clearly want to see. You want to talk about the movie, don't you?
Mark, what is your obsession with Mission Impossible 3? Are you addicted to nonstop action and thrills? Go see it. I'm not trying to stop you.
All right. So look, some say your engagement, the pregnancy, are really just all to generate publicity.
Okay. All right, hold on. Let's get real for 1 second, because that's really offensive, okay?
Yeah.
This is the most important thing in the world to me, and I'm not going to let it be tarnished by stupid rumors, okay?
Uh-huh.
Mission Impossible doesn't need stunts to get people into the seats.
Uh-huh.
It promotes itself, all right?
Okay.
But I'm here to talk about my daughter. Opens May 5th.
How'd you do in the delivery room? I know some fathers to be get a little squeamish, a little weird.
No. It was fascinating. I mean, the contractions, the whole thing, the head crowning.
Uh-huh.
I was so amazed at how wide Katie's cervix got when it was fully dilated.
Uh-huh.
I can only think of one opening that might be bigger.
All right, Tom. You know, we got to go. I'm glad you took this time out of your.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, you take care, man.
You too, Mark.
Okay, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. That was weird. All right. Well, you know, I'm glad he called, and it wasn't about Scientology.
No.
You know, I got a little nervous about that because you make fun of Scientology and.
He just wanted to talk about his kid. That's understandable.
That is understandable. So, are you? Do you have some questions for Mort? I mean, this is a guy that's got all. He started it all. I was at the Friars Club last night, and some guy said something to me. He comes up to me. I told him Mort Saul was coming on the program, and the guy says, "You know, it's because of Mort Saul that we can wear whatever we want on stage."
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to talk to him about that. I had no idea, but that was one. You know, some people remember jokes, some people remember performances, but that guy was like, "I can dress like however. I can wear this dirty shirt if I want." Because of Mort Saul.
My parents saw him in San Francisco in the like 65 or whatever I believe. They say the Purple Onion.
And how they did they enjoy it?
Yes.
I pulled out my old Mort Saul records. Hey, I got to ask him about the CD availability, man. Because I can only get one CD of Mort's on iTunes, and there's one available over at Laugh.com. The one on iTunes is like from 73. I listened to that yesterday, but I've actually got two or three of the records, and he's got like six or seven or eight records. A lot of records out. I mean, the weird thing is I guess I'm going to have to tell him, I kind of ripped off the artwork of one of the covers from my newest CD. It's more of a homage, really. I don't want to look at it as stealing, appropriating, you know, time travel, I like to call it. So we're going to have him out here. I'm looking forward to talking to Mort. And also a little later in the show, we'll talk about so many important things we've got planned. We have the obits. Mort Mortensen is going to do the obituary, as we like to do. So stay tuned, folks. We've got comic legend Mort Saul in the wings.
Live from Burbank, California, where Masons live in underground caves, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he doesn't get enough salt. Mark Maron.
That's probably true. Thank you, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course, working conservatives. We're back. Very excited about this hour of our show. We're going to have Lawton Smalls calling in just a little while. But right now, as I said before, I believe that there is a difference between a comedian and a stand-up comic. As I said before, I will answer to both, but I prefer to be called a stand-up because that's what it means to me, to stand up against something, to speak your mind, to speak the truth. That differentiation came out of the late 50s and early 60s when comics were at the cutting edge of cultural commentary and first starting to push the edge of the First Amendment and redefining what could and couldn't be said in public. Initially, it happened in jazz clubs, and one of the first true stand-up comics, I believe, is with us today. Welcome to the show, Mort Saul. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Mark.
Hey, so now jazz, we were talking a little bit about jazz before you came on.
Yeah.
Jazz, why did stand-up really, as we know stand-up to be, is what I'm calling stand-up, start in jazz clubs?
Because musicians encourage nonconformity. They'll never tell you to fit in. If you're doing something the audience wouldn't accept, they'll tell you to keep doing it.
Yeah.
They're brave. They break ground that way. And then when I got in a position where I fortunately could hire the show, I brought the music in with me.
So in terms of like the idea, certainly at that time, you know, jazz exploration and improvisation was that was just starting to happen as well. So they were able to appreciate what you were doing in terms of taking risks out there with comedy.
Also grew up with a generation that developed that taste, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody knew what Ellington was doing, and Kenton and Woody Herman, and I worked with Brubeck extensively in a modern jazz quartet.
Now, how were you looked upon at that time? Because it seems to me that even now, even with the type of comedy I've done in my life, that there is a difference between a comedian and a stand-up comic. Was there a difference between you and the culture of Hollywood in terms of comedians? How'd you get along with those guys? You know, Jackie Vernon, some of the other cats, Jackie Gale, some of the people that maybe were kicking around the scene then.
Well, you can't confuse people. It's the chronology that confuses you.
Okay.
They were around at the same age, but they're not, you know, everybody's a comedian now. I mean,
yeah.
That's what they claim.
Right.
But, you know, Woody Allen put it succinctly. He says, you can prowl a stage with a microphone, and you can curse, and you can rant, but when it comes to being funny, that's the hard part. So, unquote.
So how do you define it then? I mean, how would you define the responsibility or the task of a comedian?
Tell the truth and keep it funny.
Right. That's pretty much it. Now, in terms of when you were starting out, because it seems to me that did you feel like you were doing something that was forbidden, something that was taboo? Did you feel like that you were pushing the cultural buttons?
No. I just wanted to do that, and people weren't doing it. And that was enough reason for people to turn you away. So I just stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, we won a few people over. But I was in San Francisco, which was a pretty good crucible.
Now, a lot of people will sort of put you and Lenny Bruce around the same time, and you guys knew each other.
Very well.
But you clearly were taking different approaches. And I guess my question, as somebody who was listening to both of you as a student of comedy, is that what was your relationship, and who really inspired who at that time? Because as I was listening to the other day.
We're just real good friends.
Yeah, that was it? And so everyone was just
He was apolitical.
Right. That's what I wanted to know.
And he was not profound. That's the truth of it. I mean, the people that quote him, they use him as a metaphor for the axe they're grinding. In other words, if you stick your neck out and you get decapitated, that means that their cowardice can be interpreted as prudence.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they try to make him into Jesus.
Right.
He'd be laughing at all this.
Really?
He liked chicks and he liked music, and he didn't dwell on the culture much.
Well, that was what was interesting when I was listening to some of your stuff yesterday, is that I knew that Woody Allen was really Lenny Bruce, before he became what is known as Lenny Bruce, was a mimic. He was
Yeah, good one.
Yeah, and so I think it seems to me that you were actually probably the guy that put it in his craw that it was time to talk about politics.
Well, I grew up around it. You know, it depends what your parents talk about at dinner.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you grew up with? Did you grow up what kind of political...
Just like the Kennedys. You know, my
yeah.
old man talked about it, and he aroused my curiosity, and I read about it. And it wasn't a dilettante approach. We had real politics because we were poor.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what kind of, was that primarily, were they sort of old school, FDRites, or what were they?
Yeah, but they were free thinkers mainly.
Okay.
Real radical free thinkers. I mean, people went to the library to get the magazines they couldn't afford to buy, you know.
It seems to me that, go ahead.
The parents shaped the kid.
Sure.
He's listening.
Yep, that's true. It seems to me that now, as I was listening, I actually listened yesterday to a 1973 recording of you talking about, I guess that was almost you really came to your fame during Eisenhower and Kennedy?
Well, it kind of, the breakthrough in San Francisco, you know, I was... By that time, I was actually writing for Kennedy.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about. Now, how does that happen? How are you able to have an alignment with the presidency and with the press that you did at the time with Kennedy and Nixon, and still have the distance enough to actually take them
to
task?
The old man hired me. Ambassador Kennedy hired me.
Joe Kennedy did.
Yeah, because I was doing all these jokes about Nixon, but I exercised my right to criticize whoever got the job.
Uh-huh.
That's what my job is. So, in other words, even though he was the new sheriff in town, I'm still a bank robber by trade.
Okay.
And you do that with all of them, and it seems to get easier. I was going to ask you a question. Is that legal on the show?
What? Sure. Absolutely.
How did you get hooked up with this network?
I'll tell you, honestly, that's interesting you ask that, because I've been a stand-up for 20-some-odd years. I was out here. I just moved to Los Angeles.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I just moved to Los Angeles. I was doing a TV script for a network that didn't go anywhere. And I had nothing to do, and I heard about Air America. So I called Janine Garofalo, who I've known for years, and I said, look, I want to help take this bastard down. How do I get involved with this network? And I had never done radio before, and she gave me the name, and through a series of auditions, I got involved.
Yeah, I did her show in New York, you know, 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. How'd it go?
I did the show.
You like her?
Well, it was pretty serious, I have to tell you. it was also, you know, I thought it would have been great if she'd taken some calls.
Yeah. And she didn't take any calls with you?
No, she said to me, we're not equipped for that.
Really? Yeah. I wonder when that was, because they...
That was in the New York building. That's down there on 34th Street.
Right, so that was the old studio. That must
I was
been,
doing the Village Theater then.
It must have been close to the beginning of the game. So let me ask you a couple questions about the administration that, you know, you were, like, in this talk that you did, I heard about Nixon. It seems to me that some of the tag phrases that were in the culture now, referring to conservatism, referring to the Nixon administration, all that stuff holds true now, and some of these guys are the same guys. I mean, how do you feel?
Yeah, of course it does.
And what do you think in comparing this administration to Nixon administration? It seems like this is a little worse.
Well, both sides, as if there were two sides. There's a moral imperative with people. They're always telling you, you know, the president does bad things because he's a bad guy, and they wouldn't do that. But that reminds me of all those people who said, my parents only care about money.
Yeah.
Then they come out of college, and they care about money.
Yeah.
So the idea is not just that it can be done better or introducing any humanity. The idea is to... It's the focus on one guy. Like, you saw the 60 Minutes Sunday?
Yeah.
Well, a guy comes out from the CIA and attacks the president, which gives them a clean bill of health.
Right.
Yeah. But, I mean, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't hear Ed Bradley say to him, wait a minute, you fellas, you know, you were in the archives. You removed what you wanted to. I wouldn't do it that way, or he doesn't have to. I would try to do it humorously, because it's shorthand to be able to do it humorously. In other words, if a guy says to you, is President Bush like his father, it's quicker to say, yes, the apple doesn't rot far from the tree.
Right. You know, yeah, exactly. Okay. So you're going to be performing at the Steinway Hall, where Jim and I performed not too long ago.
So I understand.
That's right. Mort Sahl's America. That's Saturday, April 29th at 7 o'clock and 9:15. It's a $35 ticket charge, $25 if you mention that you heard it here. and that of course, is at... well, I won't give you the whole address. I will give you the number to call to make reservations, 310-471-3979, to see Mort Sahl Saturday, April 29th. For two shows, 7 o'clock and 9:15, 310-471-3979. Mention the Mark Maron show, and she'll cut you a deal. That's at Fields Pianos. That's 12121 West Pico Boulevard. I'll put this up on the website. We'll try to get a link to that so you can go see Mort. You're going to stay with us a few more minutes. Is that okay?
Sure, Mark.
Okay. Talking to comic legend Mort Sahl on the Mark Maron show. Stay with us.
And
now back to patient zero for mumps, Mark Maron.
We're talking to Mort Saul. 310-471-3979 is the number to call for reservations if you'd like to go see him Saturday, April 29th, 7 o'clock or 9:15. Mort, I tell you, it is a privilege to have you here. And I was talking about my latest CD. I only have two CDs out. I'll show you the cover. I didn't bring one with me, but I was very inspired by the covers of a couple of your records where you just had the sketch of your head. And then the title. And there was a style back then, and I kind of lifted that style.
David
a little
Stone
bit.
Martin.
Is that the guy's name?
He did all that stuff for Norman Granz.
Okay.
And then they later transferred over to Sinatra to reprise.
Right, that's the guy. Right. I tried to capture that feel. I didn't quite get that kind of feel, but
great.
It was similar. Yeah, it was great.
But, you know, the Norman Granz, that's the kind of culture that's gone. There's a guy that, you know, knew Picasso and sat down with Fred Astaire and dreamed up Funny Face. Over
right.
dinner. I mean, yeah. they were very plugged in guys.
Now, let's talk about that a minute, because I think that's an interesting thing that you hit on, is that I was born in 63, so I missed a good deal of what was, there was a great alignment between artists and writers and creative people in music and entertainment that seemed to have mythic proportions, because I think it defined what those businesses and what those forms of expression were capable of. And now it seems that everything has just become a pop culture reference and that there is no real integrity to things
anymore.
Yeah, I know.
I just did a concert in the Chicago with Dick Gregory.
Uh-huh.
We worked for a few days together there. And I come back, and a bunch of rap people are coming off the plane
mm-hmm.
with necklaces and giving $100 tips to skycaps and getting into limos. And they're saying, it is what it is. Of course, the problem is it isn't even that. But,
that?
But I didn't take them on. And then this guy next to me, who must have been a liberal, said to me, well, they've been empowered.
Uh-huh.
Black artists.
Uh-huh.
Actually, they've been disempowered because they used to be a political force.
Uh-huh.
Before the chicken dancing in the end zone on Monday night vaudeville on Channel 7.
Well, that's interesting. So what you're saying is that you feel that at the time that you came out, so at the time you were coming up, certainly in terms of the civil rights movement and in terms of what was going on culturally with the black community in terms of jazz and also in terms of politics, that do you see that there is a real difference between now and then? Because it seems to me that there is some political momentum and some of these kids are doing things that are provocative and modern. Are we just being old, do you think?
Black people have been depoliticized.
By?
They've been diverted.
Okay. By who?
Giving them sports figures as heroes and giving them, allowing nothing for education from the federal government so that people want to join the army to learn to run a computer.
Right. No, that's the fix.
They've been depoliticized. Then you mix into that the Fox Network discrediting Jesse Jackson.
Oh, sure. Any chance they get.
You know, and
it's interesting now, Mort, that it seems that this administration is funneling money into these faith-based initiatives, primarily to buy out black ministers to appropriate their congregations into the Republican Party, which I don't think is going to be successful. I can't see how black Americans could ever become Republicans.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, they could.
You think so?
It's a theocracy anyway.
Yes, we are moving towards that. There's no doubt about that. You feel like we're in it already.
Or what do my friends say to me? They say, why do those Arabs hate us? And somebody always says, because we're free.
Yeah. You don't buy it.
It's easier to join up.
Mm-hmm.
It seems easier at the time. It's actually more expensive.
The interesting thing that I found with a lot of your stuff is that unlike, completely, slandering a politician or a pop icon, you seem to use the technique of humanizing them first and letting that humanization take them down naturally.
Yeah, and if I worked for anybody, the first thing I would do is humanize them by kidding themselves. You can practice damage control that way. By the way, do you notice, Mark, that there are no current political figures with any sense of humor?
Well,
doesn't mean they have to laugh at what you and I laugh at.
I get you.
But anything.
Yeah, there. You know, some people think that Bush is funny. Then there's about 31% of the country, but they seem to be.
But the last guy with a sense of humor was probably Reagan.
Right.
In office.
He was a real showman. I mean, he was an entertainer.
And he knew some great stories.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to know, in terms of what people can expect from the show on Saturday the 29th, Mort, what are you going to be covering? Just most of the stuff that's going on today?
Politics, or? Movies, and women. All the crucial areas.
The big three. The important things. I hear you. I thought it was a very funny line. I don't know when you wrote it about Botox on your website. That was I don't know why that one stood out to me. That you said that because of Botox, there's so much Botox around now, you can't tell when a Jewish girl is angry.
Yeah, we'll see. Because of the professional liberals.
Yeah.
Of course, they would frown at that joke.
Yeah.
But their basic premise is that there's only one gender.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the premise of politically correctness has done a great deal of damage.
Jane Fonda has now become a Christian.
Yeah.
She was a liberal.
Yeah.
But so the Christian part of me forgives her.
Okay. Mort Saul, it was great talking to you. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to I'm going to be working that night, but I will definitely hear about your show. You take care. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the help, Mark.
You bet.
Now he was thrown off the Warren Commission, Mark Maron.
That's another thing that Mort Saul did. We didn't talk to him about.
Yeah, Jim Garrison,
was that he was a dissenter of the conspiracy. He was not a conspiracist.
Well, I thought he worked with Jim Garrison. I thought Garrison, he was working with Garrison.
It was my understanding that he was a doubter of the conspiracy theory.
Okay, now I'm up in the. Let's get him back in here.
Yeah, we got to get him back. Let's go. Let's get the. I'm not going to.
We can't.
We should have probably talked to him about it, but I'm not going to judge myself on it. You know, Jim?
No, I'm not going to judge
myself. We can also go do some research. But Mort Saul will be appearing at Steinway's. That is the same room that Jim and I worked in. That's going to be Saturday the 29th at, hold that thought, Mark, because I'm reaching down over here to get the paper. Thanks for filling in for me, Jim. I could have just left a pause there, and you would have been fine with that.
I'd be very fine with it. Pauses are important.
How long is a pause good for?
See, now people are really glued to the speaker.
310-471-3979. For reservations to Mort Saul, Saturday, April 29th, 7 o'clock and 9:15. You get a discount if you mention the Mark Maron Show, so do that. Guess what, folks? Good news. Well, kind of. I always like to talk to this guy for all the wrong reasons. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that listeners know what's going on in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world, so here now is our very own Planet Bush Bureau Chief, Lawton Smalls. Hello, Lawton.
Hello, Mark. God's got out the razor, and he's cutting off that scraggly long hair. Crew cut time for you, mister. High and tight.
All right. Well, look, my hair's fine, all right? So let's move on.
Whatever.
The rats just keep leaving this sinking ship. Am I right, Lawton? Now Bush's boy Scotty McClellan is gone. Goodbye, liar. See you later, buddy.
Liar? Mark, it's no wonder that elitist media lib floppers like you hated Scott McClellan. He didn't indulge your pernicious, baby-killing, Osama-financed gay agenda. Well, boo-diddly-hoo-hoo for you.
Wow. Lawton,
too bad.
Lawton, he was a liar, period. Liar.
Hey, let me tell you something. Uh-huh. The truth poured from that man like cascades of virgin spring water into crystal pools of enlightenment. Mm. On behalf of the American people, I just want to say, Scotty, you did a heck of a job.
You know what? Stop.
Heck of a job.
Stop it, Lawton. McClellan was lying. He's a lying, brown-nosing weasel, and now he's gone, and Bush has to find another hypocrite willing to defend him. Good luck with that, buddy.
Well, hey, I know a real good candidate to be the next press secretary.
Who?
Me, Lawton Smalls, White House press secretary. Lawton Smalls.
You?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, are you serious?
Am I serious? Well, yes, Mark. Why not me, huh?
Well,
why not?
Well, not that it's ever mattered to anyone in the Bush administration, but, you know, what are your qualifications, Lawton?
Okay. For one, I've dealt patiently with a hostile, liberal, faux beatnik surrender monkey named Mark Maron for 2 whole years. After that, I can certainly handle that White House press corps. Bring it on. Hey, you, Helen Thomas, zip it. Speak when you're spoken to, Grandma.
All right.
Zip it.
That job's going to take more than dealing with me, my friend. I promise you that.
Plus, okay,
yeah.
I think I've been exemplary at getting President George W. two terms mandate Bush's vision out there,
uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Staying on message. Even you have to admit, mister, I am Mr. Staying on message.
No, okay, that's
Mr.
true.
Mr. Staying on message.
Yes, sir, that is true, Lawton. You do stay on message even when it's completely retarded.
You know, I've been at home in the mirror, you know, practicing my press conferences.
Oh, no.
Go ahead, ask me something. You be the reporter, and I'll be the White House press secretary. Go on.
Do I have to? This is stupid.
Come on. What's the matter, hotshot? Chicken? Didn't bring your A game? Just ask me something. Yes, you in the front row, Mark Maron, do you have a question?
Yeah, all right. How about the...
We'll keep you posted as we move forward, but I don't have anything else to announce today, if that's what you're getting at. Who's next here?
Yeah, but what about
I made it very clear that the administration has addressed that issue repeatedly, and the American people would like to move on now.
Well, how about the...
To cooperate fully, Mark, with that investigation is part of cooperating fully with the investigation. That means we're not going to be commenting on it while it is ongoing. So, now, if anyone else has any other questions...
Lawton.
You don't need to shout. Yes, Mark?
Answer this. Why would you continue to support someone who is increasingly seen as the worst president in American history? Is spin and bullying and war the only way you can even begin to feel the giant hole in your heart, Lawton Smalls? And here's a follow-up. How do you sleep, mister? Huh?
How do I sleep? I don't. Not for months. I don't sleep.
Yeah.
You know, Mark, it doesn't matter who replaces Scotty. It's all lies. You might as well put Francis the Talking Mule up there.
Yeah.
Lancelot Link. Flipper.
Yeah.
It's all just noise that means nothing. You know, here's what comes out when Scotty opens his mouth.
Take it easy. Wow. Man, you haven't been sleeping, have you? Please take it easy. Please, you're making animal noises. All right, just breathe, Lawton, breathe. You need to sleep. Slow down, buddy. Slow down. Just take it easy. You all right? Yeah.
Flood control has been a priority of this administration since day one. Day one,
right.
And I resent the implication
all right.
there.
All right, Lawton.
Day
goodbye.
One.
Goodbye, Lawton.
All right.
Goodbye.
Hey, God loves you. Deal with it. Helen Thomas, shut your pie hole.
All right, real nice. Real nice way to hang up the phone there. That was really nice, Lawton. Okay, here we go. Let's move on. I like talking to him. I find myself laughing a little more than I used to when he breaks down. Is that wrong of me?
Maybe it's just nervous laughter, maybe.
That might be true. You know what? I actually think I am guilty of nervous laughter quite a bit on the radio. And I don't mind that. I mean, laughter is laughter on some level, isn't it?
Maybe we should have a buzzer.
What do you mean?
Every time, you know, it's nervous laughter.
As opposed to what other kind of laughter? Do we need to qualify laughter necessarily?
I think we should categorize and qualify every type of laughter on the show for the benefit of everyone listening.
I tend to notice what kind of laughs my audience has at times. I know the difference between shock laughter and uncomfortable laughter and laughing at me and laughing with me. There's many different kinds. Right now, with you generally, you know what kind of laughter I do?
What?
The kind that I'm laughing inside, Jim.
Ah, see, that's the best type of laughter, the inside laughter. It's warm. It's very warm, isn't it?
The one I just had was the laughter because I just stuck you. You know what I mean? That one?
That's okay. I'm all right with that, man.
You do it to me, too,
man. I'm okay, man.
Let's get Mortensen in here. Every week, we reflect in our time of sorrow as we look back on the lives of the recently departed. Here now is grief correspondent Mort Mortensen with our weekly remembrance. Whew. You all right?
Hey, man, how are you doing?
I'm okay, man. Are you sad? Are you gonna? You all right?
No, I'm kind of stoned.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Well, good for you.
Hey. Samuel Coster, general charged in the My Lai massacre.
General Samuel W. Coster, the highest-ranking officer charged in the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War, has died, sadly, after not being run through with a bayonet and thrown into a ditch.
Yeah.
Coster was in command of the Army's largest division on March 16, 1968, when his troops slaughtered 500 old men, women, and children in a South Vietnamese village.
You are a little stunned.
Yeah. In a South Vietnamese village, now called Little Walmart.
Little Walmart.
Yeah. Things have changed.
They have, man.
There. Yeah. Coster was not on the ground at My Lai, but he did fly over the village while his soldiers moved in. He later testified that he believed only about 20 civilians had died, largely in what he called careless bathtub accidents.
Yeah, very careless. Yeah.
Survivors include his wife, 5 children, and 15 grandchildren, who, ironically, have never been burned alive in their huts and buried in a mass grave.
You all right? You need a cup of coffee or
man,
something?
Man, I could use some, coffee.
Maybe
you
some
coffee?
Ice cream? Yeah, I got some ice cream.
Hey,
and thank some
you. Food. Take some coffee right now.
Yeah, feel better?
Edward N. Hall, father of the Minuteman missile. Colonel Ed Hall, widely considered the father of the Minuteman ICBM, died recently when one of his missiles refused to exit the silo after 4 painful hours of straining on the toilet.
You like that one?
Oh, man. It's stuffed up sinuses. It's so cold in the studio.
One of his missiles said he could get out of the silo.
Get out of the silo, but straining on the toilet. The solid fuel rocket technology that he helped develop, Mark, has been used in most other U.S. missiles, including the Polaris, the Titan III, and the Space Shuttle. And we all know how well that worked out.
No.
Yeah.
Bad.
Hall studied chemical engineering at City College of New York, but couldn't find a job after graduation because of the economy.
Mm.
It was then when he first decided to devote the rest of his life to perfecting ways to send dynamite through the air to blow up civilians.
It was a little bitter, I guess.
Yeah. You can't find a job, I'm going to
kill people.
Kill people. What's that about?
Yeah.
After winning numerous awards throughout his career, he was made a member of the Hall of Fame at the U.S. Air Force Space Command, primarily for being the only guy there who wasn't an ex-Nazi.
Yeah.
Or had lunch with Hitler.
Yeah, Hitler.
There's a pause.
But it's hard to follow the missile refusing to exit the silo
after
4 painful hours straining on the toilet. Hitler's not even going to be able to follow that.
I know. But you know me. I don't know how to pace myself or when to put jokes. Hall requested his remains be buried in 500 holes around Wyoming, Montana, and North Dakota.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, as you know, this has been another weekly remembrance. Till next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, is there a cat in here? Oh, man. That's so in my eye.
It's going to be all right, buddy.
Hey,
it's going to be all right. Maybe the cat's on me. So, look, we got some things coming up, some jokes. We're going to talk about, what are we? You know, maybe some closing comments reflecting back on Mort Saul. Yeah, why don't you just leave that music on? There's no reason to take it off. There's no reason
still
to.
Still haven't talked about Jevnes Amiatin, masterful novel, We.
Let's spell that, for Christ's sake, will you?
Well, his last name is Zamy.
Yeah.
No, Zami.
Yeah, see, this is the issue.
A-T-I-N.
Let's pull up your little apple there and see what the hell, if the damn book's even available.
It's not going to, I don't get access here real quick.
You know?
No.
I want Bill do it or somebody. Boy, man.
Eugene Zamiatin, We.
This conversation is digressing into just crap.
This
one's...
It's a very important novel.
It's failing to launch.
A precursor
whatever's
of
happening
everything that's happening at this very moment.
Are we
today
launching?
In the Bush administration.
So you're saying it's an important book for people to read even now, as is 1984.
Right now, this very moment,
I'm going to read it now. I'm reading.
Stay tuned for 3 minutes of crap. That's right, Mark Maron's short order news is coming up next. now he's willing to relax his policy on condoms. Mark Maron.
That's an interesting thing you bring up, Jim.
How's that?
Well, just this whole idea that President Bush is going to suspend environmental rules for gasoline in order to bring oil prices down. Like, that's the only idea that that guy could come up with, was to suspend more rules about environmental pollution at this period, at this juncture in history, where the entire world is talking about global warming. Granted, this idiot's belligerent and he's a monkey, but, you know, that's his first recourse, is to say, like, okay, look, you can pollute more. You know, I'm gonna
drilling in Anwar. That's, you know, the same thing. That's his only choice.
Yeah, his only choice, right. Yeah, but the thing is that his administration already curbed, you know, threw away half of most of our environmental protections around emissions, industrial emissions. But now, to address gas prices, that's what he does. He's going to allow refiners greater flexibility in providing oil supplies, since they will not have to use certain additives such as ethanol to meet clean air standards. And that's just one. And I guarantee you that I don't think this was a plan, because I don't know that they would have went to this extreme to relax more environmental protections. But whatever he's doing right now, he's going to try and make permanent, just like the Patriot Act, just like anything else.
You know who it affects mostly? He's going to gas the L.A. Basin and New York, and his two greatest points of hatred.
It's unbelievable to me that right now, 90% of the American public, including members of Congress from both parties, say they believe that price gouging is going on. And this is like right now that, you know, oil companies have made their biggest profits ever, $36 billion. For ExxonMobil, and then that guy leaves, the head of ExxonMobil, $400 million severance package, and this guy is the oil president, and he's going to try and convince us that he can't make this go away or make it better, and that the only thing he can do is make the environment worse. Well, I can't even understand how retarded this guy is. I can't even fathom how he would think that solution would be attractive to anybody, knowing that everybody thinks they're getting ripped off.
Look at his mother.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
That's
Yeah, I'm sorry, but, you know, just look at her and her behavior, and then, it's, you know, it doesn't take much to figure out how that occurred, happened.
And he said he's not going to add any more to the reserve. I don't understand the economics completely in a nuanced way of what price gouging means, but you got to figure, if a CEO is walking with a $400 million severance package, that something stinks. Like, who the hell even deserves that amount of money? No one deserves that amount of money. That was a funny bit on the Mort Saul record, on the 1973 one. He was talking about when he was with Kennedy and asking Kennedy about how rich his family was. And Kennedy says, "Was $400 million a lot of money to you?" And Saul goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "The 12 Rockefeller," and apparently JFK said, "The 12 Rockefeller brothers together have $36 billion. That's money." Like, there's could have gotten that story out of Mort, but I didn't.
So, well, you know, have him on again.
Hey, look, if you want to go see Mort Saul, why do I keep throwing that on the floor? Hold on. Yeah, talk, Jim. That's
two,
what you.
Three.
Thank you.
Four,
that's good. You're great at the filler. 310-471-3979 is the number to call for Mort Saul, April 29th, 7 o'clock and 9:15 shows. Folks, a lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure that you're up to speed and informed. So here's tonight's edition of the Short Order News. Congressional leaders of both parties are pressuring President Bush to launch an investigation into whether the skyrocketing cost of gasoline is a result of price gouging by big oil companies. In response to the high prices, the president announced a new cheaper grade of gasoline that he named himself, Unleaderer. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says repairs to New Orleans' system of levees will not be finished in time for hurricane season, although with any luck, they should be ready right after the looting dies down. How about this one? With hurricane season due to begin on June 1st, optimists are saying the levees should be fine unless it rains. Eh? A naked man was arrested after spending 5 hours stuck in the chimney of his stepmother's house. Oh, no, I used all the ones I liked. This is the...
Go ahead, do it, man.
Let's do a few other ones. The police took an hour pushing the naked man back up the chimney because they had to decide against buttering him. Yeah? Huh? The police handcuffed the naked man covered in soot despite his claims that he was acting in a minstrel version of Hair. That's a good one.
I like that one. Hey, we got a show tomorrow, too, you know. We do this show every night, whether or not there is. Look, folks. Oh, yeah, I wanted to tell you this now that I've got all your attention. If you go to markmaron.com, we will be putting most of the shows up the following day under the clip section in order to make up for what we can't control in the form of sporting events that that preempt our show occasionally. So you can go there and get that. I am shuffling around for papers because now I don't know where the hell tomorrow's show is. The guy, what's the guy's name? Spellman? Oh, man, this is a tragedy. This is a tragedy.
Tomorrow we have John Williams.
No, we don't.
Mark Toppler.
No, we
and
don't.
And Jeff Carson.
Tomorrow, I'm very excited to say, keep talking, Jim.
And these guys are famous because they have done things.
I got it. Joel Spellman. Or Spielman, the guy behind the amazing new CD, Voices from the Frontline, which actually is amazing, and apparently he knows me from Boston. I hate to say I don't remember him, but I'll find out tomorrow. He'll be here. From Raw Story, my old friend Larissa Alexandrovna will give us a lowdown on some big secrets about Chaney and whatnot. She always has the lowdown. Svetlana will come, our call girl slash movie reviewer, to talk about Flight 93. That's going to be interesting. So have a good night, Jim.
And special guest, Tom Smith.
All right. See you later, sheeple.